So if we look back to where we were, this is a painting that came from really the introduction of surgical anesthesia. And I've pulled a quote from the Harry Potter books to think about the really old days of potions and sedatives and things to ensnare the mind. It says, "You are here," speaking to the students at Hogwarts. This is Professor Snape, the potions master, speaking as I talk to my students. "You are here to learn the subtle science and exact art of potions. I don't expect you will really understand the beauty of the softly simmering cauldron with its shimmering fumes, the delicate power of liquids that creep through veins, bewitching the mind, ensnaring the senses." What a nice little description for anesthesia. Well, we indeed stand on the shoulders of giants, and the success has been brought about through the ambition, innovation, and high expectations. And high expectations of society, high expectations of our animal owners. People bring their pets to us, and they expect they're going to receive the best care available. And it's our obligation to deliver that to them. We've had advances in a variety of areas. We'll talk about inhalants, injectable agents, pain management, certainly, as we have already this morning, and we will later today and tomorrow. Talk about patient monitoring changes and advances that are in that arena. Physiologic support for our patients, which is increasingly appropriate. As we provide more and more monitoring, we realize things are not quite what we thought they might be. For instance, as we start applying an ECG, we see, oh my goodness, patients have arrhythmias. When we start putting a blood pressure cuff on, we find out they are indeed hypotensive. When we start measuring the body temperature, we find out they're cold, and if we measure CO2, we find out they're not breathing well enough. So that leads us to physiologic support, and we have advances there. These come together to result in patient safety. Let's lead off with advances in inhalant anesthesia. In the old days, it was ether, chloroform, and nitrous oxide. The first anesthetic that I ever used was ether. I have indeed used chloroform in a clinical setting. Okay. Nitrous oxide was one of the first used in human patients, and we don't use it anymore. Anybody here using nitrous oxide anymore? No. It's really pretty much gone, and that's a result of having newer inhalants available that are better and better drugs by themselves. We started off with methoxyfluorine as the first volatile anesthetic in the modern era, is introduced in 1956, halothane in 1963, isoflurane came along onto the market somewhere around 1974, desflurane came along after that, and sevoflurane. N-fluorane is not even listed up here because it's never had much of a role to play in veterinary anesthesia. Certainly the big players that we have right now are isoflurane, the predominant volatile anesthetic that we deal with, and sevoflurane, a new kid on the block that's actually very valuable, and we'll talk some about sevoflurane in this session and also when we talk about feline anesthesia later this afternoon. Properties of sevoflurane: has a very low blood gas solubility coefficient, and that means that we have a very rapid uptake, also a very rapid elimination. So as regards the speed of induction of a mask or chamber induction with a volatile anesthetic, it's awfully fast with sevoflurane. That means we can also get in trouble very quickly. It's like the difference between driving my old Subaru and driving a Ferrari. Okay, I could get in a lot of trouble if I was driving that Ferrari, and I better be careful doing it. If we do a mask or chamber induction with sevoflurane, it can be really sweet. It can be a very nice, very calm, less stressful induction for our patients, in part because of the very low blood gas solubility coefficient, in part because of lower pungency. But we do need to keep in mind that we can very quickly reach a high level with sevoflurane. Sevoflurane is non-pungent. Its odor is somewhat different for us, and those of us who have used it will know that. It is non-irritating, more importantly, to the respiratory tract. In human patients, it's not possible to do a masked induction with isoflurane. And that's not because it smells bad. It's not that people object to the smell. It's literally because isoflurane is a powerful respiratory irritant. And most people will go into a bronchospasm, a respiratory spasm, where they cannot tolerate inhaling it before they're asleep. Fortunately, our patients don't show that sign of respiratory irritation, and we can obviously do a mask or chamber induction with isoflurane. But sevoflurane leads to easier mask and chamber inductions in part because it's non-irritating to the respiratory tract. because of its rapid uptake and rapid elimination, we have a rapid control, a very quick control of anesthetic depth with sevoflurane, allowing for quick adjustments for changing needs. When I was in practice, it was a long time ago, and the only inhalant that I had was methoxyfluorine. It's so slow to make changes, okay, that I'd have to anticipate a change, move that vaporizer setting, and then finally get there, anticipate a need for a change, move the vaporizer setting, finally getting there. Instead, with sevoflurane, and certainly you all know with isoflurane to a lesser extent, as soon as we make a change in that vaporizer setting, particularly if we have a non-rebreathing circuit like a Bain circuit or a Norman elbow, we very quickly have a change in the level of anesthesia. Induction with sevoflurane is an easy step for those who are currently using isoflurane. How many people remember the transition from halothane to isoflurane? So most of us. You remember the first time you did the isoflurane mask or chamber induction? It's pretty fast. And certainly the first time a patient woke up from isoflurane. How many people had been using halothane and they turned that vaporizer down or turned it off, anticipating the end of surgery, only to have the animal bounce off the table with isoflurane? Well, that certainly is much more true with sevoflurane. With sevoflurane, we like to have the animal back in the cage or back ready to recover before we turn off the sevoflurane. The improvement can be quite dramatic indeed for those who currently use halothane, or in the old days for those who used methoxyfluorine. An easier, less stressful mask induction, easier, less stressful chamber inductions in those animals that are fighting or in those animals that are potentially dangerous. Okay. Now, this guy can hold his breath for a very, very long period of time, and we'd like to know when it's safe to take him out of the chamber. And there are some other techniques for using gas anesthesia in reptiles. One of the best is to get them, encourage them to crawl into a plastic tube. But just for purposes of illustration, here we have an animal that's potentially dangerous to personnel being confined in an area where it won't strike at us or spit venom on us. When it comes down to using sevoflurane, there's a theoretical concern. I have it listed here with the practical use. There's a theoretical concern with sevoflurane with regard to the production of a toxin that's been called compound A. It can be produced with sevoflurane. It's produced in combination of warm, moist soda lime and is a nephrotoxic compound. It can accumulate in closed circuit situations where we have a very, very low flow of oxygen going into our rebreathing system. It's practically not a concern in clinical anesthesia. Okay? It has occurred in laboratory rats. It has not, to my knowledge, been documented in clinical patients in veterinary medicine. Safety has been shown in millions of cases. Indeed, it is now arguably the most popular inhalant anesthetic in human patients. We do have a variety of agent-specific vaporizers available for sevoflurane. You remember when isoflurane was introduced, the manufacturer provided isoflurane-specific vaporizers as an incentive for a practice to go ahead and jump to isoflurane. Similarly, for sevoflurane, Abbott did that for a number of years with regard to the introduction of the drug. The solubility coefficient with isoflurane and halothane were so close that indeed for isoflurane, halothane-specific vaporizers could be used. Well, that's not true for sevoflurane. We do need a sevoflurane-specific vaporizer. Okay. Let's move on and talk about injectable anesthesia, unless anybody's got comments, thoughts about sevoflurane in particular. How many people are using sevoflurane now? Oh, quite a lot. How many people are predominantly using sevoflurane? Fewer. So how many people are using exclusively isoflurane now? Okay. So a little few. Few are using sevoflurane. Probably, I take it, about half and half those who are using sevoflurane, about half of those are using it exclusively. Seems like the predominant still using isoflurane. That's what I see in other groups of veterinarians also. We'll move on to the injectable anesthetics. Certainly, we have a long, long history using the barbiturate drugs and dissociatives, drugs like thiopental before that, thiamolol with regard to the barbiturates. The dissociative, certainly ketamine and taletamine, the dissociative that's in Telazol. Some newer kids on the block are etomidate or amidate. How many people have used amidate or etomidate? Probably, more than I expected. Really heart-friendly anesthetic. How about propofol? Yeah, wow, okay. Amidate or etomidate is a non-barbiturate imidazole derivative. It has a wonderful therapeutic index, tremendous margin of safety. Excellent agent for the cardiac patient in general. Tends to maintain cardiac output at near normal levels. So if we have the animal with really compromised cardiac function and I want to use an injectable anesthetic in general for the average cardiac patient, whatever that is, I'm going to reach for etomidate or amidate. It is quite expensive, but has a better safety margin than any of the other injectables. Better even than ketamine and Valium, which is really quite a ways up there. Spend more time talking about propofol. It's some people say it's the best induction agent we've ever had because it's so darn smooth. Smooth and fast. And human patients wake up feeling good. Okay? Not just feeling all right, but literally feeling good. Warm and comfortable, like they've had a wonderful nap, as opposed to the feeling with many of the other injectables, waking up with nausea, disorientation, dysphoria, apprehension even. On the other hand, with propofol, quite a few human patients have woken up feeling amorous. That's what I read. Okay. I think if we anesthetize a dog or a cat with just propofol and we don't do anything adverse to them, we're not doing surgical procedure, we wake them up in a calm, quiet environment, sometimes those dogs wake up wagging their tail. I think our patients with propofol have a smooth experience, a pleasant recovery. Now, we tend to think of that as a sign that it's safe, and I'd like to lead you away from that, all right? I think it's really smooth, wonderful characteristics of recovery for outpatient procedures, but please recognize that the therapeutic index or margin of safety for survivability with propofol is literally no better than it is with thiopental. And that's a surprise to many folks because it looks so good, it feels so good to the patients and to ourselves. If we have outpatient anesthesia, we'd like to have propofol in most cases. Actually, we'd like to have whatever is the favorite of the anesthetist is what I'd suggest to you. But propofol is associated with such a smooth, pleasant recovery. Wonderful for outpatient procedures. But we have to be careful as anesthetists because the therapeutic index, that difference between the effective dose and the potentially toxic or even potentially lethal dose, is not very broad. So we have to titrate to effect, be careful pushing that plunger, inject just enough that's needed. Recognize if we give too much or a little too fast, we can particularly have a lot of respiratory depression with propofol, so we have to be careful in its application. Rapid inductions, very rapid yet smooth recoveries, really excellent for outpatient techniques. And again, respiratory depression is the major side effect. Suitable in combinations with a variety of other anesthetics. There's little specific organ toxicity. No cumulative effect, really rapid and complete clearance of the drug. Its metabolic elimination occurs in a variety of tissues. One way that that's been expressed is to say that metabolic elimination exceeds hepatic perfusion. So we know there is some metabolic elimination that occurs in other tissues in the body. Even in lung tissue, there's some metabolic elimination of propofol. It's not irritating to perivascular tissues. If your needle slips out of the vein, or if hopefully you have a catheter in the vein and you think it's in the vein and it's pulled out and it's in the perivascular area, propofol will not cause the type of injuries that we notoriously have with the barbiturates like thiopental. When we talk in our next lecture about emergencies and complications, we'll see some nasty lesions on the limbs of animals where we had a perivascular injection of the barbiturate anesthetics. But fortunately, that doesn't occur with propofol. There's extensive experience and literature in veterinary anesthesia also, so this really has been a wonderful new drug for us. I may have it listed here, and I'll certainly talk about it with regard to feline anesthesia this afternoon, but there are some limitations in cats with repeated use or cumulative use of propofol. If we were to anesthetize a patient every day in a series of days, as we might for radiation therapy in some of our cats, we don't want to use propofol for that for very long. We don't want to keep a cat under continuous infusion of propofol for very long or use it for continuous sedation in some of our critically ill cats that might need a ventilator for a few days, because propofol structurally is a phenol compound. Chemically, it's 2,6-diisopropylphenol, and the phenols are toxic in cats. Now, a cat can tolerate an injection or two of propofol just fine, but if we were to do everyday anesthesia over a period of several days, we start to get some hemolytic anemia and Heinz body anemia and other toxicities in cats. So that is a limitation in the use of propofol. We do use infusions and constant rate infusions in dogs. Quite often for brief procedures, instead we'll use intermittent boluses of propofol. Again, the limited potential for repeat use in cats. There's a lack of preservative in the traditional preparation of propofol, so we need to either use it or toss it. And there's a great deal of discussion about how long we can keep a bottle of propofol sitting around, either on the shelf or refrigerated, or what if we mix it with a variety of things. And there are some ongoing efforts to incorporate preservatives into propofol. So we'll see some changes in that regard. In this instance, I have a propofol infusion going to this patient, have a syringe pump delivering the drug here as for a continuous infusion as opposed to intermittent boluses with a syringe held by hand. But please do note that while I'm relying on an injectable anesthetic, I still have the airway protected. I have an endotracheal tube placed. I still am using a breathing circuit and an anesthesia machine to provide supplementary oxygen. I still have the obligation to provide anesthetic monitoring and support just as with an inhalant. Just because I'm using an injectable does not relieve me of the obligation for airway protection, the ability to provide positive pressure ventilation, and the advantage that affords me of giving additional oxygen to the patient. Okay, let's talk about advances in patient restraint. This nice little dog has a bandage on its nose, you'll see, a muzzle to control it. Well, these days we have a variety of restraint options that were not available when I was first in this business. I remember we used to use a lot of Inivark to control difficult dogs, and fortunately those days are behind us. We have such better choices right now. My favorite for a number of years in the aggressive animal has been telazol, or combinations of telazol and an opiate, probably most popularly telazol and butorphanol or telazol and torbogesic. Small volume injected in the dog. I'm not going to take time to aspirate, make sure I'm not in a vessel. Just quickly pop that animal and get back. Allow 5 or 10 minutes for that drug to very rapidly be absorbed, get that animal in control. And not only is it rapidly effective, but the telazol also has remarkable patient safety. We tend to use it a lot in the aggressive animals because of its profound restraint characteristics and its rapid onset, but also it has a really nice therapeutic index, a good margin of safety, somewhat comparable pharmacologically to ketamine and Valium. Tends to last a little bit longer, and I think in many instances I prefer ketamine and Valium because some animals just take a long time to clear that telazol. And I think everybody's seen dogs that stumble around for a while and they're not right after telazol, particularly more so in cats, I think. And actually, it's not the dissociative component. It's not the taletamine. Instead, it's the Valium-like drug, the zolazepam, that's resulting in that prolonged disorientation. Pharmacologic tools for restraint, remember that sevoflurane. If I need to do a chamber induction these days because an animal is even too aggressive to give it an injection, I may have the aggressive cat that's cowering in the back of the cage scratching out at us. We'll take a induction chamber, put a towel over it, gently get it into the cage, trap that animal against the wall, slide the cover over, turn it up. No hands have been applied to that animal. Keep the towel over the box. The cat thinks it's hiding in a box. We start to introduce sevoflurane, and everybody's happy. Okay? In cats, for pharmacologic restraint, a little much more gentle animal that just needs a little bit of sedation, we have that advantage we mentioned last hour of oral buprenorphine. We're certainly going to talk more about cats later this afternoon. Also, with regard to patient restraint, we have moved forward in ways beyond pharmacologic approaches. We've moved away from using the rabies pole and a pole syringe. Now we have much more highly trained staff, and I think we're much more gentle in our approach in these frightened and stressed animals. It worries me to think about the old days when we used a more heavy-handed approach to trap animals and confine them and wrestle with them. That was really a destructive process for us and not very good for their welfare either. So behavioral training and skills in trained staff has gone a long way, along with our increased patience with our patients, to take good care of them for restraint. Value of tranquilization. This image was taken from Yosemite before the fire. I think those are mule deer, and you'll see some in the next talk, I believe. Advances in tranquilizers. Acepromazine is certainly the old guy and a very, very valuable drug. Quite arguably, it shouldn't be called a tranquilizer. It's more of a sedative. It does not result in tranquil patients, but results in perhaps a calming effect or a sedative effect. It does not do a good job of relieving anxieties, and none of the phenthiazine tranquilizers do. The butorphanone tranquilizers like droperidol, lenpirone, and azapirone came along a little bit later. Some of these had a short lifespan in veterinary medicine. Certainly the droperidol had a long lifespan as the tranquilizer component of Innovar Vet. Azapirone was sold as Stressnil in North America and sold in Great Britain under the much more creative name of Suicalm for mixing lots of feeder pigs. With regard to the benzodiazepines, we still make a great use of diazepam or Valium, a very inexpensive, very useful drug. It is, as you know, not water-soluble. It's a lipid-soluble drug. And as such, with the vehicle that's in diazepam, it's not very suitable for intramuscular injection. Should best be reserved for intravenous use. Lots of people use it intramuscular. Occasionally, we still will. But a much, much better choice with regard to the benzodiazepines for intramuscular use is midazolam or Versed. Okay, a little bit more expensive, a little bit more potent, an excellent choice, can be used almost interchangeably as Valium will be used. But again, is a water-soluble medication, much more suitable for intramuscular administration. Moving on to the alpha-2 agonists, xylazine or rompin, still very useful. Yohimbine was first used as the antagonist, and we have a wide variety of other antagonists available for xylazine or rompin, some of them more species-specific. For instance, in calves, yohimbine was not a very good antagonist, and some other agents were found to be superior. In more recent years, we've had detomidine and then metdetomidine developed, and then finally dexmedetomidine developed. And the attempt by the pharmaceutical industry has been to develop better and better alpha-2 medications for sedation and hypnosis, hopefully giving better CNS effect and less effect on the circulatory system, cardiovascular system. And that hasn't been remarkably effective. We still have considerable cardiovascular side effects with our alpha-2 agonists. And we can minimize those side effects to a certain extent by using very low doses. And I would suggest to you that extremely low doses of many of these alpha-2 agonists are quite effective when combined with other classes of medications, like opioids, for instance. We're using lower and lower doses of Domatore all the time and like it very much. And because we're getting away with using lower and lower doses, I'm expanding my use of Domatore to patients that otherwise, in previous years, I would have been more and more concerned, more frightened of using it. When Pfizer first released Domatore, they had a very creative approach to patient selection. And they appropriately recognized patient selection as a key factor in the success of using Domatore. They said that it should be used in healthy, exercise-tolerant patients. Okay. Perhaps the foundation for that is that Domatore, like other alpha-2 agonists, causes a tremendous reduction in tissue perfusion. It causes a pre-capillary vasoconstriction so that blood will flow up to the tissues but not through the tissues. So tissue perfusion is really decreased substantially with the alpha-2 agonists. That patient then must compensate for that as it recovers from Domitor by perfusing that tissue once again, by washing out perhaps metabolic acids that have accumulated, and then buffering that acidosis through renal or respiratory processes to get over that pharmacologic challenge. Their rationale in recommending patient selection based on young, healthy patient is that the animal that could go out and play with the kids, chase the cat, catch the frisbee, the animal that was exercise tolerant can buffer that acidosis, that physiologic challenge that comes from exercise. They could presumably also buffer and compensate for the pharmacologic challenge that would come from the alpha-2 agonist. Does that make sense? Okay. I think that was a wonderful approach. It's kind of a sensible approach. Your clients know if the animal can still get around and is exercise tolerant, and we have that feeling for our patient. I think that's a good way to look at it. Many of us extended it not just the healthy exercise tolerant patient, but the young healthy exercise tolerant patient because of the cardiovascular side effects of the alpha-2s. But again, as we're getting farther and farther along in our experience, we're using lower and lower doses. One of the experts who first advocated the use of that particular alpha-2 Domitor is Dr. Bill Tranquilli, University of Illinois. And Dr. Tranquilli, great name for an anesthesiologist, Dr. Tranquilli recommended what he called a microdose approach, 10 micrograms per kilogram of Domitor added to some opiate. And that was a number of years ago. These days, we're more often using like 1 to 5 micrograms per kilogram, and it's actually rare that we'll go to 5 micrograms per kilogram. Sometimes 1 to 3 is quite enough. Any other thoughts on alpha-2s? Chance for me to get some water here. We'll move on to talking about opioids. Gosh, we've got a whole variety of medications. One day a number of years ago, quite a few years ago, I opened up the controlled drug cabinet and just lined up the opioids we had on the shelf at the time. That's a small selection. Morphine is, of course, the prototypic opioid that we have available and is still such a fantastic drug, such a valuable, valuable opioid. Oxymorphone played a very prominent role in veterinary anesthesia and analgesia. There were some interesting problems with availability of oxymorphone for manufacturing reasons that led to the increased popularity of morphine a number of years ago. I think oxymorphone had taken over as the predominant strong opioid analgesic. And there are some problems with availability in the mid-70s and mid-80s. And as a result of that, we rediscovered morphine in veterinary anesthesia. And then more recently, hydromorphone, or Dilaudid, has become a very popular and very useful strong opioid analgesic in dogs and cats. And it's certainly one of our favorites now when we need a good strong analgesic. Very inexpensive, very effective in both dogs and cats. As I mentioned earlier, there's some limitations with morphine analgesia in cats. It still is a very useful drug, but it probably does not have as much efficacy as it does in dogs because cats lack the enzyme that converts morphine into an active metabolite, morphine 3-glucuronide. So cats have to deal with the parent compound, whereas dogs get the benefit of that metabolite as well. Hydromorphone, very effective in both species. Fentanyl has been popular in veterinary medicine in the form of the Duragesic patch, which we discussed in part in the last hour, talking about cancer pain. The Duragesic patch was produced by Janssen Pharmaceuticals solely for use in human patients and solely for use in managing cancer pain. Never designed for use in animals, never approved for use in animals, and yet we do have a very extensive literature on the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of Duragesic patches in a variety of animal species, and we have wonderful literature available for us supporting the use of Duragesic patches. I always must remind everyone that there are limitations and safety issues with regard to the dergesic patch, with regard to the potential of the animal to get to and ingest some of that gel that is contained within the patch. There's also a tremendous potential for diversion and misuse and abuse of the fentanyl patches. Even the spent patch contains a tremendous amount of fentanyl. And remember that these patches were designed for treating a human adult, okay, for a 3-day period of time, not for our much smaller patients sometimes. One of the most popular applications has been in declaw analgesia in cats. And remember that even the smallest dergesic patch was designed for treating a human adult. Okay? Butorphanol, a very popular drug in veterinary anesthesia, available in several different formulations, tablet as well as liquid, several different strengths. The Stadol is one of the human preparations. There's also a nasal spray butorphanol for human patients for breakthrough pain. I know some people who have been on that in the past. I would emphasize that butorphanol is not a very good analgesic, particularly not in dogs. It has a much better sedative effect than it does analgesic effect. So I think in veterinary medicine we still overuse torbogesic or butorphanol, particularly thinking that we're going to get a better level of analgesia. Our patients have some sedation that's better than the analgesia. I'd also like to emphasize the cost factor, if I can. Butorphanol is among the most expensive of the opioids that we'll use and among the least efficacious when we need substantial pain management, particularly for dogs. Its efficacy is arguably better for cats. If we're going to use butorphanol in dogs in a perioperative setting, quite often we'll use the butorphanol or torbogesic early on as a pre-anesthetic because it is well absorbed, has a nice sedative contribution right along, right very quickly. But for analgesia, I'll often add in another opioid, certainly in the post-operative setting, if not before that. So I may start off with butorphanol and then switch to buprenorphine. I might not use buprenorphine as my pre-operative opioid analgesia because the onset with buprenorphine, even if it's injected intravenously, is very slow. Peak onset in 30 to 40 minutes, even if given intravenously. Okay. So again, if I'm going to use butorphanol early on in a preoperative setting, if we're going to go on and do some surgery, I'll usually reach for a different opioid, particularly in dogs, if I want to deliver a decent level of analgesia. And again, keep in mind the cost factor. For a big dog, butorphanol is incredibly expensive. Moving on to local anesthetics, the drug used, lidocaine, is our proteotypic local anesthetic, extremely valuable, extremely old drug. When we talk tomorrow about local anesthetic and regional and local techniques, we'll talk a lot about lidocaine and increasingly about bupivacaine or marcaine. Very, very nice complement to our local anesthetic choices. We make application of these locals through regional and specific nerve blocks, infiltrative or splash blocks, also neuroaxial analgesia using either epidural or spinal route, and increasingly we're making intravenous infusions of local anesthetics, of lidocaine specifically, in dogs, not in cats, but in dogs for surgical, operative anesthesia and analgesia, and also post-operative analgesia, and also in some critical care settings. Lidocaine is extremely inexpensive in this application and extremely efficacious. A nice, safe choice, and we're going to talk some more about that tomorrow. With regard to the local anesthetics and bupivacaine or marcaine in particular, it's available in single-use vials, 10 ml vial, costs $1.60 in our pharmacy, and a tremendously valuable and cost-effective medication. I was mentioning to someone earlier, if I need to go in the hospital and have some surgical procedure done, I'm going to take a vial of it with me, and if they don't use it, I'll use it myself. It really, really reduces our need for other analgesics. It reduces the need for anesthetics during the case. Patient wakes up much better shape, and we block those nerves before we'll transect them. In this case, we're doing a maxillary nerve block. Again, in our session on local anesthetics, we're going to talk about the techniques necessary for a variety of these specific nerve blocks. But very simply, these local anesthetics can be used to infiltrate the margins of a surgical wound. Nothing can be easier. At the end of surgery, if not preemptively, even at the end of surgery, infiltrate the margins and the patients wake up so much better. Moving on quickly to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, have a wide variety of those to talk about. Certainly aspirin being the oldest, phenylbutazone was certainly popular in veterinary medicine for a long time. Ketoprofen has been, and a lot of people still using ketoprofen. More recently, carprofen or Rimadyl. Etagesic or Etodolac, sold as Lodine in human patients. It was pretty popular, I think less so now. The newer kids on the block are Deramax or Daracoxib, Prevacox, and other NSAIDs are widely in development still. We see more and more of them coming on all the time. I don't think there's any group of pharmaceuticals where we've had a greater advance in different choices of medications in the recent years than with the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And there's so many different studies out, so many advertising claims, it's hard to make sense of it all. I think all of us have our favorites, and I think it's very appropriate. Patients differ in how effective each of the NSAIDs will be. And that's true for us as well. Some of us achieve good pain relief with ibuprofen. Some of us need to use Nalive or naproxen sodium. Some of us need to use Feldene or other medications. And that's true in our veterinary patients. One NSAID will be effective in one patient and not in another, and vice versa. And that changes with time also. And the same is true for the potential toxicities. Gastric irritation can occur in people with a variety of NSAIDs. Just as it can occur, gastric irritation can occur with a variety of NSAIDs in our veterinary patients, and it's very much individual dependent. And that changes with time also. A patient may tolerate Deramax for a period of time, and then all of a sudden they have some GI toxicity. It may be necessary to switch to another non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. Most pharmacologists recommend if we switch from one of these medications to another one that we allow a washout period so that we avoid the cumulative toxicity. There is such a thing as called the aspirin-induced lipoxin. Excuse me. The combined use of different NSAIDs, different non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can be associated particularly with GI toxicity. So a washout period when switching from one NSAID to another is very appropriate. Now, I've listed in parentheses here acetaminophen or Tylenol. It's often lumped in together with the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, but recognize that it's a very, very different class of medications. It does not have anti-inflammatory characteristics and can be combined with the traditional NSAIDs in dogs. Of course, acetaminophen or Tylenol is extremely toxic in cats and cannot be used in cats. But in dogs, as in human patients, we can have a combination of Tylenol along with a variety of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and they act synergistically. As far as a mechanism of action, acetaminophen or Tylenol actually binds to a cyclooxygenase enzyme. It's called COX-3 in the central nervous system and probably in other tissues, but can be combined with other traditional non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications and is often combined with opioid preparations like Tylenol 3 and Tylenol 4. We need to recognize that tremendous individual patient variability in both safety and efficacy. We need to have skill in the management and use of NSAIDs. So I imagine everybody's got their favorite in NSAIDs and hopefully two or three favorites. We can limit the toxicity by choosing COX-2 selective agents, and that's very controversial. There are also cytoprotective measures available. Some of the evidence on COX-2 selectivity and COX-2 specificity is very much dependent upon the research model in which it was generated. In advances in pain management, we'll look at acute pain, operative and trauma care, and also in chronic pain with regard to arthritis and cancer, and also with regard to advances in critical care analgesia, an area in which it's lacking. With regard to acute pain, this is the first area in which we saw a real benefit for our patient. It's the first area in pain management in veterinary medicine in the operative setting where we saw real advances, great progress that our clients can also recognize. We're increasingly using neuroaxial analgesics, epidural morphine, or combinations of epidural morphine and a local anesthetic like bupivacaine. It achieves 12 to 24 hours of substantial analgesia and is really quite a crowd pleaser. Okay, Our technicians and students all love the epidurals, and when they learn how to do them, they like them even better. We teach all of our students how to do epidurals. In fact, our technical staff now trains our students how to do epidurals. It's technically easier to do an epidural injection than it is to place a lot of the peripheral IV catheters that we place in some of our patients. Now, we've already talked some about fentanyl or duralgesic patches. They can be very useful, providing a consistent basal level of strong opioid analgesia, typically in dogs about 3 days, in cats maybe 5 days. Can be used as an alternative to sustained-release morphine, which doesn't work well in some dogs. In other dogs, it does work well. But again, their use is strictly off-label in veterinary medicine, and we need to take precautions to make sure that the animal does not get to that patch and ingest it or chew it up. And also we need to take precautions recognizing that the patch can be very toxic to humans and there are abuse potentials as well. We've had advances in chronic pain management, both with regard to arthritis, primarily through those NSAIDs, and with regard to cancer pain, the topic in the last lecture. This comment right here, I've updated this in my presentations, okay? Remedil is one of the medications for chronic pain management, specifically that degenerative joint disease. 3 million dogs on everyday Remedil. It's now up to 5 to 8 million dogs on everyday Remedil. Remarkable market penetration. With regard to cancer pain management, as we discussed in the last hour, we recognize that there are many causes of pain in the cancer patient. We need to recognize those and address them, be diverse in our management options, use multimodal analgesia just as we do in surgical pain management. We titrate, adjust, and balance care, and we can really do a tremendous service to keep that animal in that human-animal bond. With regard to cancer pain management, we've discussed the World Health Organization strategy for management pain that's based on an escalating level of pain control from mild, moderate, to severe pain. There's that analgesia ladder where we stack on stronger and stronger opioids in combination with typically non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs as cancer pain becomes more severe. In critical care analgesia, our patients that are in intensive care settings or tremendously sick or injured, we have very well-defined advantages for sedation and particularly for analgesia. The mechanisms are well-documented whereby patients benefit from analgesic strategies. We have lots of tools available, and yet the application of those tools to relieve the animal's discomfort and stress are often lagging. The same is unfortunately true for human patients in a critical care setting. They're uncomfortable, and they need not be uncomfortable. They're stressed, and their stress can be managed to a certain extent. Analgesic therapies that are available, particularly in a critical care setting, will start off with thorough nursing care, and that needs to really be at the top of the list. Sometimes altering the environment helps. You know, sometimes if you're lying in a hospital bed, it's nice to have some company, maybe turn on the TV, open the window shades. Other times you want people to leave you alone, close the blinds on the window, and turn off the television. But altering the environment to suit the patient's needs is really what it comes down to. That can be helpful. Distraction and relaxation techniques may involve that visit from friends or visit from the owners. Opioids, strong opioids, are at the forefront of pain management. We use the local and regional techniques increasingly in critical care and occasionally those alpha-2s at very low doses and a variety, wide variety of other strategies. Okay. If we want to look at three principles in pain management, we'll discuss this some more tomorrow, but the principles are preemptive, balanced, and a willingness to dose to effect. Okay? So keep those in mind, and that's been responsible for a lot of the improvements in patient care. Like to dose early, dose before the knife hits the flesh, dose before the patient hurts, and certainly before the last dose wears off. We're going to use a balanced or multimodal approach, combining different classes of drugs. And we're going to give until it helps, like the United Way says. Give until it helps. Okay? None of the dogs or cats came to the lecture this morning. They won't be reading the notes. They won't know about dose recommendations. We need to give until we achieve the desired analgesic effect or change the analgesic strategy, add in some complementary classes of drugs. Give until it helps. Advances in monitoring, and we're just about out of town, but the American College of Veterinary Anesthesia has some suggestions for advances in monitoring, and the guidelines are available on the ACVA website with regard to monitoring different physiologic processes, some idea of how well the patient's breathing, some idea of how well their tissue perfusion's going, some idea of tissue body temperature, response to stimulus, and we have a variety of technical and non-technical ways of addressing those monitoring needs. Okay, pulse oximetry, blood pressure, airway analysis. Here we have a monitor several years ago from Heska that's being used on a parrot that we had involved in a research study. And I believe you can see here the pulse rate of 450 beats per minute. I was amazed this device could discriminate that heart rate, and yet it did. It had a good waveform display. And I think when you're buying a pulse oximeter, it's valuable to buy one that has a waveform display so you'll know whether your machine is picking up a good signal that's useful or whether it's picking up garbage. Okay? If it's garbage coming in, it's garbage coming out, and you can't rely on the numbers. There are a lot of things that can fool us with regard to pulse oximetry, a lot of things that give us false low readings, but fortunately, we don't have a lot of things that give us false high readings, so we don't get a false sense of security, and that's nice. Amy, we're about out of time, aren't we? Just about. Okay. So there's that pulsatile blood flow that we get with pulse oximetry. 1 minute, okay. I'll leave you with a discussion of monitoring blood pressure. How many people are measuring blood pressure now with a Doppler, or if that's great, with a non-invasive blood pressure device? As we do this, it leads us to recognizing a need for more and more fluid therapy, also a need to reduce our vasodilating techniques. As we've started measuring blood pressure more and more, we've administered fluid therapy to more of our patients, and we're also finding ways through combination strategies of using more opioids, more dissociatives, maybe CRIs of lidocaine, lidocaine, morphine, fentanyl, or lidocaine and ketamine. We find ways to minimize our inhalant dose so that we maintain good blood pressures. You folks have any comments or thoughts we need to talk about? We could go on and talk further, but I want to take a little bit of time to address your concerns. Yes, sir. Oh, yes. The question is CO2 monitoring. That's the next big one to come along. Okay, if you folks have taken the step of blood pressure monitoring, pulse oximetry is less expensive, so you've probably already been doing that. The next major step is to measure carbon dioxide in the expired gas. That's really an excellent way of knowing how much respiratory depression we have. All anesthetics are respiratory depressants. There aren't many absolutes in my business, but that's one of them. All anesthetics are respiratory depressants, so it makes sense to evaluate respiratory depression. And the best way to do it is to evaluate carbon dioxide in the exhaled breath. Capnometry or capnography is the way we measure that. The materials, the tools are out there. There are a variety of capnometers and capnography equipment on the market, some of it on the used market, some of it on the new market, paralleling the situation that you saw a few years ago with blood pressure measurement. You can get into it relatively inexpensive. It is a big jump forward. It's a wonderful complement to your anesthetic monitoring. Just as with blood pressure, it is something that you should use. If you've got it, use it on all of your anesthetized patients. Depreciate that cost. Spread it out over all of your animals, and you can rapidly pay for that otherwise expensive piece of equipment. So, yes, sir, it is very much worth considering that. Things to look for in buying the units, you want to compare two fundamental approaches to measuring CO2. One is inline capnometry or mainstream capnometry, where the sensor fits between the endotracheal tube and the breathing circuit. And the other one is sidestream capnometry, where a sampling hose sucks a sample of the air that's exhaled off to the machine. There are advantages and disadvantages to both of those. The sensor for an inline capnometry is kind of fragile, so you need to be kind of careful with that. One of my favorites in that area is from Novometrics, I believe, and it's the Cosmo monitor, CO2 SMO monitor, and it measures inline or mainstream capnometry and also pulse oximetry. There's a wide variety of sidestream samplers, and I'm sure you'll see some in the displays in the exhibit hall. If you buy one of those, you should get one that has a low sampling rate. A lot of the earlier equipment had a sampling rate of 200 mils per minute. That's too high for a lot of our small patients. Look for one that has a sampling rate in the range of about 50 mils per minute instead. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments? We're really out of time. Yes, one more. Absolutely. Question is, do we worry about dead space when you start adding those sensors? And you do. And either one of those sensors, either one of those approaches can add dead space. If you add the inline sensor, even with the pediatric sensor, that adds some dead space. For the pediatric sensor, it adds a few mils of dead space. And yet it's designed for the very small patients. So we do use it in our very small animals. We might use a low-volume breathing circuit also. The other approach, if we put an adapter in there to sample the airway gases. With some of the equipment, we can instead take an intravenous catheter and punch it through the wall of the endotracheal tube and avoid adding that dead space. But the addition of dead space is a concern when doing capnometry. Good question. Thank you all for your questions and your comments. Thank you for being here.